welcome, good evening. Welcome to Christchurch Clifton. I see that we've been very British and not gone on the front tables. hopefully you will have someone who's got a lanyard on at your table. If not, then I'm going to come join this one in a minute. But tonight is the second evening in a three-part series of the parenting sessions, parenting your teen for emotional wellness. And we're really excited to have you here this evening. Thank you so much for coming out on a bit of a wet evening. Toilets are downstairs if you need the loo. Fire exit, in the event of a fire, we'll go out the front doors here and gather on the green at the front. And if you want tea or coffee at any point, then please feel free to go and grab one from the back. We are really aware that the pandemic has taken its toll on people's mental health, and we've especially seen this in a lot of the young people that we work with, and I'm sure that you are aware that, of the crisis that's going on in teen mental health at the moment. But at Christchurch, we still believe that that our young people can thrive and that they can overcome the adversities that they are facing at the moment. And so we really hope that this evening you go away with some practical tools, but also you go away with some real hope that things can change and that your young people can overcome whatever it is that they're facing at the moment. And tonight, Catherine is going to be talking about how we can build our children's emotional well-being in a post-pandemic world. So hopefully it'll be really helpful for you this evening. We are around tables, as you can see. We're going to be having some times of discussion this evening, interspersed with Catherine speaking to us. So hopefully you'll find that helpful. Sometimes it might be a parent on your table who has just what you need, the wisdom that you need. So hopefully those times will be really helpful for you. We're also aware that for some of you, you might be in a place of real crisis at the moment with your teen or young people that you're working with, and you might need support in that. So the people who have lanyards on your tables, they're really happy to chat with you one-to-one if that's something that you would like. Also, we're a church hosting this, so we believe in the power of prayer. So if you would like prayer, then you're very welcome to ask for that as well. We'll have some time at the end where you can do that. But I would love to welcome up Catherine now. Catherine, yeah, great. That's a round of Catherine is the director for Care for the Family in the UK. She's a well-seasoned parent and now grandmother. She's got some great wisdom for us. So thank you, Catherine, for being here.
Brilliant. Thank you, Sophie, so much. And shall I give you that, my second one?
Oh, yes, wonderful.
Lovely. And can I just add my welcome? It is so great to see you all here this evening. So as Sophie said, I'm Catherine. I'm married to Richard. We have four adult children and as of 2 weeks ago, now five little grandchildren, which is a delight. So we have weathered the toddler season and the teenage years and I am still standing. And I really hope and want to echo what Sophie has said, that we want you this evening to go away with hope and with something that you'll be able to do differently, maybe see things slightly differently, that will encourage you on this important journey of being a parent. And I'm speaking on the issue of emotional well-being and as parents, how we can sow the seeds of that and how we can help our teenagers with that. And as Sophie said, I work for the charity Care for the Family. We are a charity that seeks to strengthen family life. And so if we can help you in any way at all, in couple relationships or in any issue of parenting, then check out our website and we would love to be able to offer you support. And in relation to that, I've written a couple of books on the issues that we're going to look at this evening. And just for you only, there is a special offer tonight. If at the end of this evening you think you'd like to look a little bit more. This one is called A Mind of Their Own, Building Your Child's Wellbeing in a Post-Pandemic World. And this one is called Left to Their Own Devices, Confident Parenting in an Age of Screens. And they're £12.99 each, but tonight if you want them both, for you only £20. And that'll be at the back at the end. Happy to sign one for you if you would like that as well. But I reckon we are all in different situations, aren't we, this evening? So some of you may be parenting on your own. Others may be parenting together. Some of you may have one child. You may have a whole host of children. For some of you, life probably is going pretty well. You haven't had any big crises recently, but for others, you will be in a really difficult situation. And I just want to acknowledge that all that will be in the room, and all those seasons come to all of us at some time or other in our parenting. And the reason that we want to talk about emotional well-being, the reason that Sophie has asked me to look at that tonight, is it is such a key thing for us as human beings and such a key thing for our children. Our emotional well-being, it's about how we think, it's about how we feel, it's about how we relate to others. It affects how we see the world, and it's a really important part of our overall well-being. And so what I want to do just to start, I know you've had a chat already with each other on your tables, but why don't you just take a couple of minutes, in case you haven't introduced each other, find out who's on your table, find out what their shape or size of family is, and just in a couple of minutes, what you are hoping to get out of this evening, and then we'll come back together. Just a couple of brief minutes for that, and then I'll call us back together. Okay, well, let's come back together again now, and there'll be two more opportunities during the course of the evening to talk a little bit more around the tables. But before we go any further, I'm going to show you a little film that we put together, just very short little vox pops, and we asked some children this question: what are the things that you worry about? And this is their replies.
Some of the things that worry me are my upcoming A-level exams and moving away to uni next year.
I worry that my Lego will get smashed when someone's walking in my room.
I worry about not being the best version of myself, things not being perfect, whether people like me, whether I like me.
One thing I worry about is like my future aspirations, what I'm going to do when I'm older, and what I'm going to do with my life, to be honest.
One thing I worry about is school, like my math homework.
Like Voldemort, I worry about people who slayers me, who make me slayers, and grandpa, and...
What worries me is like the future and not being in control.
I'm worried about my pets dying. Tim and Oriole. They're only little dwarf hamsters, so they don't last that long, and they're my first pets.
Having nothing to do.
I worry about my scary dreams.
I worry about when I jump, Daddy won't catch me.
Well, it was one of those moments that no one in the room would ever forget. There was a psychologist, and she was talking to a group of young parents about the issues that she was seeing in the children that she was counseling. And halfway through the evening, a woman who I think had already been fairly vocal in the Q&A session, she interrupted, and she said, "These kids, they just need to toughen up a bit. When I was their age..." But she never did get to finish her sentence because the psychologist interrupted her. She put her hand up for her to stop. And she said, "Madam, you were never their age." And I think that psychologist was right. Our children, our teenagers, are growing up in a world that is in many ways light years away from the world that many of us grew up in. In fact, recently there was an exhibition that was put on by the Children's Society. It was an advertising campaign, and they had a shop window with items in that were designed to reflect modern childhood. And in the shop window were a child's stab vest, a notebook containing dark thoughts, anxiety concealer makeup, and a mobile phone case covered in messages of fear and worry. It's a worried world that our children are growing up in. And in fact, this was just last week. I think every week there is some stats about mental well-being amongst our young people. But this one, just last week, children's mental health in crisis as cases rocket to a record high. A toll of 400,000 patients triggers alarm over the scale of problems since COVID. Because that advertising campaign that the Children's Society put on, that was before COVID. That was before issues of climate change hit our media and before news of the war in Ukraine and talk of a third world war just added to the things that our children are worrying about. That's the bad news. The good news is this. As parents, and maybe there are some carers here this evening as well, you are in the very best place to be able to encourage your children and to build their emotional well-being. In the same way that when our children are little, we know how to help them grow healthy physically. So we put stair gates on the stairs so they don't fall down. We teach them to swim. We teach them to cross the road on the green man. We limit sugar. We limit screen time. In exactly the same way, there are loads of things that we can do right in the everyday ups and downs of family life that can enable our children to grow emotionally. It's harder to spot and it's harder to measure, but we are in that. There's libraryfuls of research that tell us we're in the best place to do that. So we can be encouraged. So I'm going to begin by looking at three building blocks, three things that we can do to help build that emotional resilience in our children's lives from the get-go. And if your children are in crisis at the moment, as Sophie said, do seek support if you need it. But these principles apply across the board, whatever your situation. And the first one is this: giving effective praise. So every day our children will be hearing words said to them or about them. Some of those words will be encouraging and will build their self-esteem, and the others of those words will be damaging to them. As parents, we have an amazing opportunity to speak positive, encouraging words to our children, just in the everyday things of family life. But when our teenager is still in bed and it's already time to leave for the school run, we've lost the car keys, we've got a little one whose nappy needs changing, the last thing most of us feel like doing is just pausing and having that wafty moment of speaking encouraging words. It's really hard in the ups and downs of family life. But if we can do it, if we can seize those moments to do it, it can make all the difference. In fact, there's a wonderful proverb that says that our words have the power of life. And we can literally be speaking life to our teenagers by the words that we speak. And I heard a lovely story that illustrated this. It was a teacher, and she told me when she was a young junior teacher, she had her first parents' evening. She was a cookery teacher, and she set up her table, and one of the first parents came along. And she said to her, "What's your daughter's name?" She said, "She's called Claire." "Oh," she said, "I'm so pleased to tell you, Claire is a model student. She arrives on time, she listens, she helps other students." The mum looked very shocked, if a little surprised, but went on to the next table. Later on in the evening, another mum came and she said, "Could you tell me your daughter's name?" "Claire," she said. And in that moment, she realized she had made a terrible mistake. This was the Claire that was the good student. The other Claire was a completely different kettle of fish. But she said she'd said it. It was too late. Nothing she could do. And so she carried on. Well, a fascinating thing began to happen. Because the mum of the Claire that was not the good student noticed that she began to change. She began to arrive on time. She began to try harder. And the mum began to praise her for it. And the mum later said to that teacher, "You were the first person to have ever praised her in that way." And that word of encouragement had enabled her to get better, not just at the cookery, but at every other subject as well. It enabled her not only to believe that change was possible, but that she could change. So the power of our words It's really important to build well-being. And the lovely end to that story is that that little girl went on to become a cookery teacher herself. Now, we can obviously praise achievement, but it's good also to praise effort and to praise character. So I have a little grandson called Ezra who is 2, and he recently started nursery. And my daughter was thrilled because the first week he came back with a bright pink neon star and a little report, which she thought was a little over the top for a 2-year-old, but hey. And she thought, what has he done to deserve this star? Has he recognized the first letter of his name? Maybe he's done a jigsaw puzzle. Maybe he's done a lovely painting. And she read the star, and it said this. It said, Ezra is kind. He shared his tissues with the other children. Well, we laughed so much. I thought in these COVID times, to be praised for sharing snotty tissues was quite funny. But you know, I think that teacher was wise. Whether we're 2, whether we're 22, whether we're 92, it feels good when someone praises our character. And I hope my daughter will build on that. I hope as he becomes a teenager, she will remind him how kind he is. And he will go on to be a man that is known for his kindness. When our children were teenagers, we would try to praise character, but we'd also try and praise effort. So when they'd done their exams, we're in exam season, aren't we, at the moment. When they'd finished the exams, we'd try and do some high-five moment. Maybe we'd go out for a pizza or something to mark the fact that they tried hard. But we did that before results day. Giving effective praise, first thing we can do to build well-being. And then the second is this, helping our children develop a realistic view of themselves. Now, with 4 children, I can't tell you the number of junior school sports days I have attended over the years. It's normally just like now, isn't it, when we've had lovely summer and then suddenly it starts raining just in time for sports day. And when they were little, we would line up and we would cheer as they put bean bags into buckets and did that hoop thing around their waist and sprinted for the line in the running race. And then we would all be gathered to the other end of the playground and we'd gather round and we would clap and we would cheer again as every single one was given a star certificate for taking part because everyone's a winner. Now, I get the logic of that. And if I was a junior school teacher, I would have done the same. And the logic goes like this, that good self-esteem is built on, well-being is built on good self-esteem. Good self-esteem is built on praise, so praise is important. But the trouble is, we end up praising our children for anything and everything. We tell them that they are Harry Kanes or Elon Musks or J.K. Rowling's in the making. And we're not specific in our praise. I definitely fell into that habit when organizing birthday parties for little ones. So the game of pass the parcel, there would always be exactly the same number of layers of paper as there were children in the room. And then mysteriously, the music would stop randomly, but every single child would get a chance to unwrap a layer. And then the present in the middle would be to share, because again, everyone's a winner. Now, I would defy any parent to do otherwise when faced with a room of sugar-fueled 6-year-olds. But that way of thinking has crept into our culture, particularly for our teenagers. If you think about the things that we're watching on the television, the reality TV, things like Love Island, Britain's Got Talent, social media, things like TikTok, they're all giving our children the message that they need to be extraordinary, that everyone can be extraordinary, that everyone can be a winner. Now, this is hard because as parents, of course, we want our children to do their absolute best. We want them to succeed. Any single one of your children could play in the Premier League, could be a famous children's novelist, could be a world-famous scientist, but they can't all be it. And the world is telling our children, putting a huge pressure on them, that they have to be the best, that they have to be extraordinary. I have to be extraordinary is a huge pressure on them. And then no wonder that they face anxiety and disappointment when no one presses that golden buzzer for them, when the world itself tells them that actually maybe they're not quite so extraordinary after all. Whether they are four or five, when they're four or five, we need, of course, to praise them for anything and everything. But that isn't going to sustain them when they're 14 or 15. And when they're 24 or 25, their boss isn't going to give them that star certificate just for turning up to work in the morning. It's the real world that we're preparing them for. So I want to make what I think is a controversial statement. I was in a debate with Vanessa Feltz on Radio London about this, and she definitely did not agree with me. But I think we, in this culture where our children are told they have to be extraordinary, I think one of the best things we can do as parents is to give them this message. It's okay to be ordinary. But by that, what we mean, we need to just redefine what we mean by ordinary. We don't mean a boring second best. We don't mean not doing the best that they can, being the best them that they can be. But let's just take that pressure off them to have to excel at everything. We can redefine that as parents. We can be the ones that tell them that different story, that life isn't a competition. And at the very heart of emotional well-being is their ability to be able to embrace reality, to embrace their strengths, but also to acknowledge their limitations and to be the best them that they can be. And we can help them do that. And then the third building block is called help them develop what's called a growth mindset. If there are teachers here, you will know a lot about this. Because this isn't about not telling them and not encouraging them to try harder and to improve. So Jamie has gone down to the Lego store in town with his grandpa. He's spending his birthday money and he is choosing a Lego set. And he spends ages looking and then eventually settles on the Lunar Space Station. Now, this Lego set is much harder to do than any he has ever done before. But he says he is the best at Lego. Everybody tells him so. So he buys it. Well, fast forward, little scene in the kitchen, and there the Lego set is strewn across the floor. Jamie is angrily kicking it against the wall. It's been much too difficult. He's refused to let his grandpa help him. Don't know about you, but a scene like that has often happened in our family over the years. Now, when faced with a difficult task, we can adopt one of two different mindsets. So the first is called a fixed mindset. If you have a fixed mindset, you believe your ability is fixed. That if you're rubbish at maths, you will always be rubbish at maths. But if you're really good at maths, then success is guaranteed. The other way of looking at the world and approaching a difficult task is with what's called a growth mindset. And that's what we want for our children. Growth mindset believe that your giftedness is just the beginning and your success is due to hard work and to effort. Now, even the most accomplished people believe that some hard work and effort is required in order to succeed in life. So a while ago, Ed Sheeran, the musician, was interviewed on the Jonathan Ross show. And he said this, when people say artists are born with talent, you're not. You have to really learn and really practice. And then another musician agrees with him, Mozart. He said this, writing a letter to his father, he said, people make a great mistake who think my art has come easily to me. Nobody has devoted so much time and thought to composition as I. If we can come alongside our children when they're facing a difficult task, encouraging them to believe that they can grow, that they can learn, we'll be giving them that opportunity for lifelong learning. And that is a really important building block in their mental well-being. There's a little phrase that used to go around our house and maybe around yours as well. be mom, dad, I can't do it. You can add one little word that will change everything. You can't do it yet. Growth mindset. Now, at the end of each little section, I want to give you something practical, something that you can do at home that you can take away. And for this section, the thing that I would love to leave you with is this. Practice praising effort. Practice praising character. Even if your teenagers are driving you barmy at the moment, find something that you can praise them for. Rob Parsons, who is the founder of Care for the Family, has a lovely story of, I think it's his wife going into their son's bedroom, which is knee deep in stuff, and she's remembered that she has to find something to praise him for. And she says, son, at least the ceiling's tidy. So that's the, come on in and come and have a seat at one where there's some people. That would be lovely. Or wherever you like. We're going to, okay, go down. We'll pause in a minute. So that's three building blocks that we've seen for building well-being. So I'm going to just talk for a little bit longer about one more thing, and then on the tables we can talk about them. And this is about that important quality of resilience. It's a word that's bandied around a lot in relation to well-being. And the scientific term means bouncing back. It's about it's when a substance bounces back into back into the state that it was in the beginning. But recently, scientists have made a different definition or built on it. And instead of bouncing back, it's bouncing forward. So it's not just going back to how things were after a difficulty or a challenge, but it's actually bouncing forward and learning from it. Resilience. And resilience is key. Resilient people, resilient teenagers, resilient children are more optimistic. They make better friends. They have better communication skills. On most indices, they do better in life. It's a really important quality for us to learn. I was talking to a psychiatrist about this, and he told me a lovely story. He had a little boy who came back from school, and he said to his dad, Dad, we learned about resilience at school today. And my friend was very pleased to know they were talking about such an important subject. And so he said, oh, what did you learn? And he said, that resilience is bouncing back. And he said, that's great. What's bouncing back? And he thought for a minute, and then he said, we haven't learned that bit yet. The point is this, of course it's really important, and it's good that schools are teaching these things, teaching what resilience is, but that's only the theory. The way we learn resilience is in the hard knocks of life, time and again coming back and learning from challenge, learning from failure. So, when we're faced with a difficult task, there often are two different approaches that we have. And we might well recognize that in ourselves as well as in our young people. So the first one is to internalize our frustration. So we can't do something and we say it's a really difficult bit of homework, and then to internalize it would look like, oh, I'm so rubbish at geography, I can't ever do it, I'm hopeless, and just spiraling downwards. That's internalizing it, which obviously is a natural thing to do, but doesn't help us move forward. The other way is externalizing. That's the other natural approach or response when something's difficult. So say again, same bit of geography homework, but this time it would be, my teacher is so rubbish, the school's so rubbish, the system's so rubbish, the exam was ridiculous, or whatever it is. So externalizing, blaming somebody else. Now, it's obvious that neither of those two things are very fruitful. They're often ways that our children go. But what we need to do as parents is help them step back. So recognize that internalizing or externalizing probably isn't going to help. Step back from the problem and just feel sad. And that's a hard thing as a parent. I always wanted life to be easy for our children. I hated it. I hated seeing them struggle. And I was always much too quick to zip in and try and make life easy for them. But if we allow them to step back, to feel sad, they can have a look at the problem again. And if it's something that can be solved, then they can have a go at it. And it's a bit like a painting going round and round and round, each time having more and more layers. Resilience isn't something that we're born with. It's something we learn. And the family is the best place to be able to learn it. And it's not that some people are more resilient than others. You might show different sort of resilience in a different situation. But as parents, we can be cheering them on and helping them with that important quality. I don't know if you've heard of the helicopter parent. So helicopter parent, that would be me. We just very quick to go in, rotor blades whirring, to swoop in and help them out of any difficulty. The number of times our boys were at school here in Bristol and I'd get the text, I've forgotten my mouth guard, hockey boots, whatever it was. And I would so quickly, oh, they must have them, be jumping in the car and across Bristol and rush hour traffic to deliver said item. Whenever I didn't do it, they never, ever missed the match. Where there's a will, there's a way. And they learnt from it. So that's obviously some things we need to help them with. But actually helping them and having the resolve to help them learn things the hard way builds resilience. Well, that's quite a lot of information already. So we've looked at giving effective praise. We've looked at having a realistic view of themselves. We've looked at the growth mindset and resilience. So for a few minutes now on your tables, just have a chat about that. Was there a particular one of those that resonated with you? Maybe you didn't agree with it. What are your challenges can you see in your family life like that? And what could you do differently? And just to say, let's agree together that things that people share on the table stay in the room, and then people can be free to share. So I'll give you about 7 minutes for that. Sorry to interrupt your discussions. And we're going to look at a couple more things now, and then there'll be more time to talk with each other after that. So I want to look now at how we help our teenagers manage their emotions. So emotions are obviously important, and they are different in the home depending on what season of life we're in. So when we have little ones, there will be complete meltdown because their drink is in the red cup rather than the green one, or you've given them fish fingers and the beans are just touching the fish fingers, or whatever it is. And they just haven't got the emotional scaffolding to work out the depth of their feelings, and they have meltdown. But the teenagers, as most of you will know, are equally volatile. Sometimes it can feel like there is a smoldering Mount Etna in the middle of your kitchen and you're just creeping around the edge, just wanting to be quiet, not set off another eruption. Now, emotions are important. Emotions are often called the smoke alarm of the brain. It's an important signal that something needs to happen if we're feeling something. But like smoke alarms, they're sometimes not reliable and they're sometimes not truthful. The smoke alarm can go off because we burnt the toast or because there's a spider in it, or a smoke alarm can let us know that the house is burning down. Now, in relation to emotions, there are some very important things that you need to know about the teenage brain. And if this is new to you, I can guarantee this piece of information will make a massive difference to you in parenting your teenagers. Because since MRI scanning, we've found out that there is a lot of brain development that takes place during puberty. We used to think it all took place in toddlerhood, but in puberty, there's a massive amount. One expert called it a rewiring upgrade. It makes the brain faster and more efficient. But the bad news for our children, but also for us as parents, is that different parts of the brain develop at different rates. And the very last bit to develop is this bit at the front, which is called the prefrontal cortex. This is the bit that is responsible for regulating emotion. This is the bit that is responsible for helping deferred gratification. It's the bit that is responsible for us helping make sensible long-term decisions. This bit of the brain is simply not yet developed in our teenagers, which is why they do barmy things like jump off hotel balconies or go cycling without helmets or play Fortnite till 3 a.m. the night before their GCSE exam or whatever the issue is. Our teenagers don't have this bit of the brain, so instead they use the bit that is developed, which is called the amygdala. That is the seat of the emotions. And so they are literally thinking with their feelings. One mum, after she heard this, she said to us, "This is such a relief." She said, "Because now I know not only is it not all my fault, but it's not all his fault either." And as parents, we need to help our children just manage these emotions, the highs and the lows. And it's important that we experience both positive and negative emotions. That's life. And again, as a mum, I would so often want to smooth it over and just say to her, "Oh, it's all fine. Don't make a fuss. You're okay." Instead of really using that as an opportunity to come alongside, to connect, to find out what was really going on, and just simply to be there for them. Sometimes when emotions are running high, it's like someone struck a match. And our job as parents is to help them blow the match out rather than fan it into flame and cause a big fire, helping them manage their feeling. But the other thing we need to do as parents is to help them manage their thinking. Now, again, I would find it so hard when our young people had got into a downward spiral of negative thinking. And just beyond, it was beyond me. How do I help them snap out of this and start to think differently? And actually, there's a lot of science that shows that it is much easier for us. Our brains are just wired that we more easily flip to negative thinking rather than positive. And that is particularly the case for young people. But the good news is that our brains aren't fixed. There is something called the plasticity of the brain, and it means that they can change. And we've put together a little animation that explains how that works. So we'll have a look at that now.
Our brains are incredible. We can remember things we've previously learned, and we can learn new skills. But did you know we can also change ingrained habits and behaviours? Imagine you've been regularly walking down a familiar pathway in a forest, but now you want to change direction, so you try to form a new pathway. Everywhere you turn, there are branches and weeds blocking your way, and brambles tugging at your clothing. Getting through that forest is hard work, but you make it. You leave behind a few flattened weeds and some trampled bushes. The next day you walk along that new path again, only this time it's slightly easier to cross, because you began to forge that pathway yesterday. Day after day you continue to cross that same forest until eventually there is a clear route through. The branches and weeds are truly trampled and the brambles are cut back, and the way is clear. Now walking through this forest becomes simple, painless, and perhaps even enjoyable. And if you ever had to go that way again, you'd automatically choose the new pathway you've created. It's now the best route to take. And now, the old pathway has become overgrown. In the same way, our brains look for paths to follow. When we come to a scenario we've previously encountered, our brain looks for the easiest pathway, a route we've previously taken before. Maybe a thought process we've had many times, or a skill we've learned through repetition. Our brain naturally finds the most well-worn path and takes that route. But instead of taking the old paths, our brains can in fact be retrained to do new things, or do things differently. It can be hard work, and more so for adults, because we've been treading down those paths for years, even decades. This can cause us to have anxieties. But we can learn new skills. We can overcome negative thought patterns. And we can even learn to relate to people differently. It is possible to change our habits. Our brains truly are incredible.
Our brains are amazing, and we can help our children forge those new pathways. But like that showed, it can take effort and it can be hard work. So Leah and Maria are doing what they love doing best. Saturday afternoon, they're in town, they're squashed in the changing room, trying on clothes, taking selfies. In the evening, they post them on social media, and they get loads of likes. But then, as they're going to bed, Maria takes a little look at her phone, and so does Leah. And Leah sees that she's had a few comments, and one of the comments says she's got scrawny arms, and she feels really sad. She thinks, I know I've got scrawny arms, I don't work out enough, I'm rubbish, I'm so ugly. And soon, the power of negative thinking has taken her to a dark place, and all the joy of the day has gone. Maria checks her phone, and she also has a comment. And that says she's got a fat tummy, and she feels hurt. But then she thinks, and she remembers something her mum said to her, when there was a nasty comment, a mean comment that was made on the bus on the way home last week. And she remembers how she chose to rise above that comment. And then she thinks about the top she's bought. And she thinks it's a really good bargain. And she actually thinks she looks great in it. And although she's hurt by the comment, she's able to deal with it and to rise above it through choosing to think more positively. And we can help our children do that. And in that way, when we do that time and again, that will train their brains with those new neural pathways. And the action point for this is something that you can help your teenagers do. It's called blue to true thinking. And it's how we help them catch those negative thoughts, challenge them, and then change them. So they have what's called a blue thought. So a negative thought, or they're catastrophizing about something. And we get them to write it down in a notebook or put it on their phone. And then we tell them the truth. And they write that down. The opposite of that dark thought. Pop it on their phone, pop it in their notebook. And then they can go back to it. When those negative thoughts return, they have something to go back to. It's a simple thing. Doesn't happen overnight. But we can help them gradually with their thinking. Our children have all the raw material to be emotionally well. They need a hand to hold, they need a listening ear, and they need us as parents to be able to draw those qualities out in them. So managing their thinking, managing their emotions. And then I just wanted to say a quick word about the digital age. And I don't know if you often feel on the back foot in terms of what your children are doing on social media, even during the pandemic, where we've all leveled up a bit. But here's a little DVD, a little video that I think you'll enjoy.
I am the master of entertainment. I know how to control your TV.
I know which remote controls which box.
I know how to cast box sets from the tablet.
I'm the only one who can find that episode you missed.
I know how to connect the laptop to the TV.
Season 2 isn't in the same place as Season 3, and there's other shows on this and also on this.
We are the masters of entertainment because we are 7. You are not. You need help.
We are 7 and you are not, and you need help. So often we feel on the back foot with the digital age. And if you want some guidance on that, there's so much in this book to help navigate through. But just a couple of things to highlight where the pressure of the digital age is affecting our children's well-being. Time on screens. Now, in the pandemic, they were of necessity on screens 24/7. It was a lifeline. There's loads of good, but it also has a shadow side. And not just the sedentary lifestyle, not just not having face-to-face contact with people, but also lack of sleep. And lack of sleep affects mood and it affects well-being. I hear of teenagers that are setting alarms at 2 and 3 in the morning to check their social media feeds. Of course that's damaging their well-being. Gaming, again, there's loads of really good games that promote well-being and that give good information and help creativity and lots of good stuff. But again, they can be addictive, they can draw us in. The World Health Organization has a category now for an addiction, gaming addiction, as a recognized disease, a recognized illness. But before you all panic and think that your Fortnite-obsessed teenagers have this, it's very unlikely. If you are concerned, do get some help. But most likely, it's just an all-consuming, really annoying hobby that gets in the way of family mealtimes and family life in general. There was an Ofcom report, and a young lad called Jack, who was 16, was interviewed. And he'd broken his leg at the beginning of the pandemic. And so he was spending all time in his room gaming. And when the interview was done, he had been on a 9-hour relay. And his grandmother was so stressed about him spending all this time in his room, she'd offered him, I can't quite believe this, but she offered him £500 to come out of his room for meals. And guess what? He didn't do it. So such is the allure of gaming. But just one thing about gaming that does affect well-being. It's worth thinking. If you're concerned about the amount of time your child is gaming, just ask yourself the question. Take a step back, because games can be a means of escape. So it may not just be the gaming. It may be masking some other issue. It's just worth thinking that one through. Bullying, social media, the pressure that they have to create an identity that often bears no relation to real life. And they know even if they get loads of likes, they can't possibly live up to it. They see their friends' social media feeds, and they know that they're filtered. They know that they don't reflect reality. But somehow they forget that, and it puts a huge pressure on them. And for children, most of our young people have had 2 years online. And when life is tough, the life online, to be honest, has been more reliable, more colorful, more exciting than lockdown. And they will have gone deeper into it. So it's not about saying it's all bad, but just about trying to manage that in the home. And the best thing that you could do, because many of us have had to throw up the rule book for any rules that we had in the home for managing the digital age in the home. We had to throw it all in the air with the pandemic. So now is a really good time to get on the front foot. And I do something called a family media agreement. And all that means is you get together your whole family, teenagers, if you've got little ones, parents, and you talk about what are your ground rules for managing technology in the home. And the world is your oyster. People often have three columns. Yes, you can. Ask us first. Don't even think about it. And it can cover anything. Do you have phones at the meal table? Do you allow screens in the bedroom? There was one thing I would say is, if at all possible, don't have screens in the bedroom. Many people are buying these big multi-chargers, and the whole family charges their phones in these at night, even the parents. So the boundaries, the ground rules that you set up, this is for the parents as well. And it's good to make it positive rather than just a whole load of things that they can't do. But helping them realize that this isn't making their world smaller. This isn't a straitjacket that we're putting them in. It's a seatbelt. It's to keep them safe. So that would be a good thing to do. Get them all together. You can make it fun. Get some snacks. Make it a fun evening. And even the most grumpy, uncommunicative teenager, if they're listened to, if they think that they can influence and genuinely can the things that you're talking about, if they've got skin in the game, they'll take part in that. So I'd really recommend that. And then finally, just a word on identity. We've covered a lot, haven't we? We've looked at lots of different ways of the building blocks for well-being. We've looked at resilience. We've looked at managing emotions and thinking. But I would say, if I had to choose one thing that is at the heart of this, it would be identity, helping them discover their identity. This is the task of the teenage years as they step back. As they discover who they are away from us, their parents. The trouble is, they're not on a level playing field. Our culture is so loud, and there are so many things pulling them in different directions. So 15-year-old Blair, he reflects on the different identities that he carries every day. He is popular and outgoing to his friends, but to his family, he's shy and introverted. Then there's Blair to his teachers, there's Blair in the band, Blair to the girls, Blair to the lads. And somewhere in the middle of all that is the real Blair, the one that only occasionally makes an appearance, the one he really needs to get to know. Our children are being told by culture that to find out who they are, they just need to look within. But the problem with that is they have nothing to base it on. There's that in the Frozen Disney film, no right, no wrong, no rules for me. I'm free. But it's just not true. We all need something to base our lives on. And a leading psychiatrist called Martin Seligman, he talked about the fact that as we need to encourage our teenagers to raise their gaze and to have what he called a something bigger than me mindset. So this is at the heart of well-being. I think that's why our young people so readily want to be part of a tribe, or they want to campaign for a really important issue of social justice or whatever the issue is. They want to be part of something bigger. And this psychiatrist also said this. He said, the truth about meaning is this. The larger the entity you can attach yourself to, the more meaning life has. Now, I understand that, I know that here tonight, you will represent all faiths and none. But this event's been put on by our church and the church youth group. And I know for me that being able to come alongside our children when something was troubling them, and to be able to explain to them that there was a possibility of a God who loved them, who knows them, who has a purpose and plan for their life. That, for me, was a really great thing to be able to do. And this same psychiatrist said that one of the key factors in establishing and discovering identity was religious hope. But whatever place you're in this evening, and whatever your beliefs, whatever your values, what our teenagers need to know is that they are loved unconditionally. And we have the power to do that. We can let them know that whatever they've done, however many times they've failed, whatever they look like, all those different metrics that the world puts on them, that irrespective of those, we accept them and that we love them for who they are. Will we make mistakes as parents? Of course we will. Will we have regrets? Undoubtedly. But we have it in our power to be able to show them that love and acceptance. And that is the key to helping them develop a mind of their own, helping them develop that emotional resilience that will last them a lifetime. So in this last few moments, I've got one story that I'd love to share with you at the end. But let's have, say, another 7 minutes in our groups and talk about these different same questions, but for these subjects that we've just looked at. Managing emotions, managing thinking, the digital age, identity, lots. So maybe just choose one or two and talk about those. Then we'll have some time for questions. So you might like to talk among yourselves if you've got any questions. I'd be happy to answer. And then we'll end. I've got one story to end with. So have a go with that. So we're just, in case anyone has any questions, I want to leave enough time for that. So if you want to just bring that conversation, sorry, I didn't want to land it on you just like that. If you want to just finish any conversation you were having. And then if anyone does have a question, I think there's a roving mic so people can hear. Very happy in the remaining time to answer any questions. But if you haven't, do carry on chatting on your tables.
Hi. We were just talking about the managing emotions, and our daughter is 15 and she suffers with anxiety and low mood, and she goes up and down. She knows everything she needs to do to lift her mood, but sometimes it's really hard getting her to do it. And I think she just can't be bothered. And when that happens, she gets worse and worse and worse. And as a parent, I don't quite know how to bring her out of that without, like, physically saying, come on, let's do this. And so your thoughts on that would be really helpful.
Thanks so much. So I think there might be other parents in the room that have some wisdom on that. But I think being there for her, being in that space with her, listening to her, letting her know that you love her, that you understand, that it's okay, that she's feeling low and that it won't last forever. I think that's one of the most powerful things you can do. I don't know if anyone else has got any. Oh, hang on, 2 seconds so people can hear you if you don't get them.
I empathise with where you are. We've had experience with this too, and it's really frustrating as a parent because you want to fix it, don't you? You don't want them to be feeling like that. But I think what Catherine said of acknowledging that they are where they are and not trying to fix it, because you can't actually fix it. In fact, trying to fix it makes it worse sometimes. So just recognising you're there. And sometimes they don't want you in the room either, which is even worse. So inventing reasons to go in. Can I just get you a cup of tea? We'd like this glass of water. And, you know, it can become a bit of a joke, but in a nice way. Of, yep, Mum's here. I'm still here. But I'm now coming out of the room, leaving you some space, but I'm still here. And checking in that they're safe as well, because it could be even worse. It could be self-harming. It could be suicidal thoughts. And I think recognising that that might be at play sometimes, and just being present, and you have a responsibility to keep her, for, you know, it's okay for you to keep her safe, but just stepping in, yeah.
That's really helpful. And I think the other thing to remember is that we often think they don't listen to us, they don't miss a thing, and how we manage our emotions, we are role models to them in that. And so when we're feeling low, what we do to keep ourselves topped up to manage those lows is really a really key thing as well. So
can I just add, I think it's really important as well to give them a bit of choice in it, like to let them own when they are ready to come out of it. So I think as a grown-up, someone was saying to me, snap out of it, do this, and this. It wouldn't work. But in my own time, I will be ready to say, could I have help? And I think that's quite important for that age, any age.
That's really good, yeah. There was one over here. But it is so hard because as parents, well, I certainly hate it when they're not okay. And it's learning to live with them not being okay and it being okay for them not to be okay.
I just wanted to say I agree with everything that's gone before, but I know from experience with my own 15-year-old who has ups and downs, she can slip over into a totally irrational state where nothing will work. And at that point, I pack her off to bed. Because that's the only thing. She's just tired.
Mm.
And it's as simple as that.
That's really helpful and practical.
Am I allowed to ask the next question?
Of course.
So I have 3 children that say that they all have social anxiety. I don't think any of them really do, but I think there's all these words are now out there. And there was one girl that came over, she was 15, and she said, well, you know, I've got GCSEs coming up and I feel terribly stressed, so I'm going to need extra time. And, it's all very stressful, this, and I can't cope with it. And how do we kind of walk the line between what they've got is a real problem and this is real social anxiety, and this is just something that you've picked up from everyone else, and actually everyone feels anxious about going into a GCSE exam?
Very good. That's really good. And that, I think you're right. There has been a ramping up of this language. I'd never heard of social anxiety when I was doing exams. So I think you know your child best. You love them best. And you know, I think, more than anyone else, as a parent, we know when our child is just a bit anxious, because these negative emotions serve a purpose. It's good that they're a bit anxious about exams, otherwise they wouldn't do any revision. And when it tips into something that is spiraling and we need to to get help. So I think talking about it, having conversations with teenagers in the car is always good, without eye contact if possible, making that part of family, and then also talking about how you respond when you are anxious about a particular situation and how you manage that, I think normalizes it. So I think, again, talking and being role models for them in how we navigate those things can be really helpful as well. So I don't know if that's, yeah. Anyone else got anything to add on that one? Here we go.
Hi. We talked a lot on our table about that as well, about things becoming increasingly fashionable. And that was a word we used, particularly in terms of things that they maybe, in terms of how they identify, whether it's having social anxiety, whether it's sexuality, and the role that school has in that, vis-a-vis our role as parents and how we would like to parent them and the values we would like to give them. And that's a real challenge, because it seems to be so much more prevalent now than it ever was 10 or 15 years ago.
No, that's exactly right. And I think it is not a level playing field. It really isn't. But there is so much research that children take on the values that they see lived out in the home. And they need to be lived out rather than just something stuck up on the fridge. But there's no guarantees. There's absolutely no guarantees that they will. But we can give it our very best shot and know that that actually those are the things that they will be, they'll be imbibing really as they grow up. But again, I think talking about to the school, finding out what is being taught in the school, is that in line with what you're talking about in the home, and just keeping those conversations going, I think is really, really key. I think I don't know if people were at the last of these sessions, the previous one, but I think that was a lot about communication. So go back on that one. Here we go.
Hello, just jumping back on to that one about anxiety. I think when we're under test, whether that's an A-level or a GCSE or any kind of test as an adult or a child, then that sense of being assessed and perhaps not coming up to the standard that we've set for ourselves is always going to cause stress and always going to cause anxiety, and there's no way we can ever get around that. But social anxiety is different to that, and social anxiety I think a lot of people have, and it's one of the conditions that people don't generally get help for. They just manage it and live with it. And I think, I'm thinking back to some training that I've done on it, it's about 14 years on average that people's life is debilitated to some extent if they've got real social anxiety before they go for help, if they ever do. But actually, as far as diagnosable mental health conditions go, it's one of the easiest to treat and one of the most easy to diagnose as well. So if there is the potential of social anxiety, it's worth kind of doing a proper exploration of have they actually got that, because it is a fashionable world. But I think probably around 10% of people, even before the pandemic, they thought have social anxiety.
Thanks for that. I think I was talking to a psychiatrist who was saying that very often if we're really concerned about our children, we jump to CAMHS, Children and Adolescent Mental Health Services, which we will know if we've seen in the news is just really long waiting lists, really hard to get appointments, really hard to get seen. And whilst that is really important if our children need it, what he was saying is there's loads of steps on the way that we can make so much difference to our children. So it's not all or nothing. It's not, they don't go from 0 to 100 like that. There's all these different steps, and the biggest stuff can happen in the home. And he was really, really clear on that. So maybe one more, if there is. Yeah.
Going back to identity, What advice would you have for a parent whose child comes home and says that they now feel they identify as the opposite sex and they want to change their name
mm-hmm.
to something else?
So at Care for the Family, we get several questions of that nature now every week. I have a niece who was previously my nephew, who is trans. So I have some personal experience of seeing that journey, really. And it is complex, and it needs a lot of love and a lot of care. But I think that one of the keys is to work out, is this just a bandwagon, a bit like we were talking about before, of just trying out these different things, or is it a genuine thing that does need some attention? It's a very small minority that it does need some genuine gender dysphoria. I think key is lining up with your family values, whatever they are. And key is, I would say, depending on how old they are, but if they're younger, I would say slow it down as much as you can. Talk about it, keep communicating, keep being there for them, keep loving them, and as you can, slow it down. If they're older, then that's harder. So for my now niece, she was 18, so my sister is her mum. She had no say in what was going on, because she could just go and get appointments, etc. So that's why family values are so key, because you can line it up with those, and then I would just say keep communicating, keep loving them, and slow stuff down so it doesn't accelerate away as much as you can. I know that's not a watertight answer, but those will be my initial thoughts. But if people want to talk about that or any other issue, I'm super happy to hang around at the end. And also at Care for the Family, we have something called Care Line, which you can just ring. It's a confidential line. There's trained counsellors who will listen. They will talk to you, and they can signpost as well if there is stuff that you need. So, and I know the team here would be able to provide help and support. Is that right? Let me just tell you one story to end, and then Sophie, you come. But this is about one of our children who, when he was little, he could not tie his shoelaces. 100% just could not tie them. Every single morning going to school, there was this complete drama about his shoelaces. And he'd be in tears and he'd be cross. And I, so many times, I thought, why don't I just buy this child some Velcro shoes? It would be so much easier. But I didn't. And we persevered. And he went round and round that resilience loop that I talked about. And eventually, he learnt to tie his shoelaces. And I am really glad that I didn't buy him those Velcro shoes, because that child is now a surgeon. And he can tie really good knots. And I'm glad about that. And so I imagine are his patients. There we go.
Thank you so much, Catherine. That was really, really helpful. We have our next parenting session coming up on the 13th of July, and we have Rory Robinson, who is a senior clinician at Off the Record, coming to speak to us, and Jack Reed, who is a adolescent mental health nurse. And they're going to be giving you a bit of a toolkit of mental health tools that you can use with your young people, and how to notice signs if they're in distress. So that'll be a really helpful practical session as well, just to build on everything that we've been learning. Also, I just wanted to point you to some resources that you can find online that are really helpful, that have loads of helpful stuff for parents and for your young people. So Off the Record is a charity in Bristol that supports young people's mental health. They have loads of stuff online, and also they have drop-in sessions. They do offer one-to-one counselling, but obviously waiting lists are really long, but they do have group sessions that young people can go along to as well. Papyrus is a charity that is dedicated to preventing suicide in young people. So if you know anyone who is struggling with suicidal thoughts, they are a great place to turn to get support, and for parents as well to find out how to deal with those things with your young people. Young Minds is another fantastic resource as well. Loads of things on there for parents and young people. Spear Bristol is something that is happening in this church at the moment. It's a program for young people to help them get into employment or education. It supports their confidence and their well-being, and it's just been a fantastic program that we've seen loads of young people come out of transformed and ready to go into whatever is next for them. And then also we run some weekly youth groups here. So on a Sunday morning and a Friday evening, we run youth groups for young people to come, to meet friends, to talk about faith, to explore topics like this and other things that affect them. So yeah, if you'd like to know any more about those, then please come and have a chat with us. But yeah, thank you for being here this evening. There are people, like I said, on your table who've got their lanyards on. If you would like prayer or you would like to chat with someone about anything that's come up this evening, then please do grab them. But if not, hopefully we will see you next time. Thank you so much. And thank you again to Catherine. And also, just a little reminder that there are books at the back if you want to read any more about what Catherine has been talking about. There are some books for you to look at the back.